morning. Just putting a timer in front of myself so I don't take my full 4 hours. Yes, family. Bit of a tough one to prepare for, I feel like, because we're obviously going through what we feel are the kind of distinctives, the really things that are unique about our community, not unique in that no other church expresses as family, but the things that we really have had a focus on. And I feel like family is a kind of difficult one to talk about because it's such a foundational piece. It's almost, I'm not saying this to be like, I had the hardest job, but but it's such a foundational piece and it's such a, it's the way in which we, it's the kind of foundation under which we do all the other things. We express all the other values and distinctives and everything kind of flows out of that. When we think about our vision statement, it begins with to be a family. And then everything else that happens after that happens within the context of us being a family. So it's first and foremost, we're a family of wholehearted people, and then everything else gets expressed out of that. So I want to just take some time because I think there's a tendency with family to feel like, oh yeah, I understand that, family of God and God's a father and kind of brothers and sisters, and that we have some understanding around that concept. And sometimes we can fall into this kind of like Christian politeness version of that, where it's like, you know, my brother's in Christ and we're all together. But I want to kind of move through some stories about Jesus and see how does Jesus form community? What does Jesus' invitation to community actually look like? What is Jesus's community like? And spoiler, it's like family. And then what are Jesus's radical ideas about family? Because I think sometimes we have this idea that Jesus is really like, it's really pro-family, but I think Jesus has some really challenging things to say about family. And then, I guess, what does it mean for us once we finally kind of try and apply that? So if it's okay with you, we're going to hit a fair bit of scripture because we're going to just tell some stories about how Jesus did it, and then we'll lift some insight from there. So let's do that. So we're going to start in Matthew 4. So we're going to move through a few stories in Matthew, if you're following along. So Matthew 4. Now, as Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and his brother Andrew, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, I will make you fishers of people," or fishers of men. Immediately they left their nets and followed him. Now, like, it's easy to think there that Jesus is making a corny joke, that, you know, like you're fishing and all, you can fish people instead of fish. Fishers of people is a common first century idiom. Like that would have been a phrase that they understood to mean a great rabbi or teacher who would capture the hearts and minds of people. So it's not just Jesus being like making a bad dad joke. It kind of is, because it's like there's a reference there, but it's more like this would have been Jesus saying to them, like, I will make you a great teacher like me. Like you, I'm gonna show you the ways to really capture people with your wisdom. So it's not just like they've abandoned their trade for somebody who made a joke. There's an offer there. There's an invitation there. Going on from there, he saw two brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, in the boat with their father Zebedee, mending the nets. And he called them. Immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. And follow has more of a connotation really of apprenticeship. I mean, you think about that idea of fishers of people. He's not just saying, come and listen to me preach as I wander around. He's saying, I'm going to actually demonstrate to you, I'm going to show you, and you can apprentice under me so that you will become like me. So that's what the connotation of follow is here. And we learn early on, like this is Jesus calling his first disciples. So we learn early on that to follow Jesus is to live in community. You actually don't get to follow Jesus as a disciple and go, all right, I'll see you when you come back around through this area and you can tell me all the new things you've learned. And like these people have given up everything, abandoned their fathers in some instances and walked away from everything they've ever known to apprentice under Jesus. Like that's a big call. So to follow Jesus is to live in community, to leave your life and family. There's this high bar of entry that we're being presented with here. And we skip forward a few pages to Matthew 8, verse 18. Now, when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to depart to the other side of the sea. Then a scribe came to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes and the birds of the sky have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, allow me first to go bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." Again, this "bury my father" is not this literal term. Like, it's not like this guy's saying, "My father's just died. I've got to go have a funeral for him." And then, like, this guy's actually saying, "Let me return home, wait for my father to die, receive my inheritance, get all my affairs in order, and then I can come follow you. If I abandon my family now, I miss out. Like, I don't get the reward of my inheritance." So I don't think this is Jesus being extremely callous, but he is presenting a very high bar of entry. He's saying you have to actually give something up to be in relationship and to follow me. Again, like, it's like you have to leave everything you've ever known to be in this community. I kind of love that we get no conclusion out of this story. Like, it's kind of this perfect self-insert as we consider the call of Jesus and the cost of following him. Like, we don't get to know whether that man actually said, "Yeah, you're right, Jesus, I'll do that," or whether he went, "It's too high a cost." So it's kind of this perfect moment to reflect and be like, "Oh, what? Like, have I considered the cost of what it means to follow Jesus?" And some people were ready and willing to give up everything to follow Jesus, and for others, it was just too high a cost. We move forward just a little bit to Matthew 9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's office, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. Then it happened that as Jesus was reclining at the table in his house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and began dining with Jesus and his disciples. As if Jesus is hanging out with tax collectors, who were the friends of tax collectors and sinners? It's other tax collectors and sinners. You know, tax collectors were not in high regard. So if you were a tax collector, probably your friends were all the other tax collectors. So they're gathering. They're like, "Oh, it's okay. It must be okay." So they're starting to gather around Jesus. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why is your teacher eating with tax collectors and sinners?" There's so much like cultural context to this, but eating with somebody was a real, like, it was almost like condoning somebody's behavior and existence to actually break bread with them. When Jesus heard this, he said, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. Now go and learn what this means. I desire compassion rather than sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners." So there's people from across the spectrum in Jesus' community. Like, Jesus' community isn't just good law-observing Jewish boys like James and John and Peter and Andrew. Like, those exist and those are in there. We get tax collectors like Matthew, who are, you know, Matthew's part of the 12. We get Judas Iscariot, who we're about to read about. There's this kind of wide array of people represented in Jesus' community. It's not an exclusive community. So what's kind of what's the thing that Jesus is looking for when he's kind of inviting people in? That's the kind of curiosity we get here. Is like, what kind of community is Jesus forming if he's not forming a community of, you know, well-educated, well-informed Jewish people? So a bit further forward in Matthew 10, Jesus summoned his 12 disciples. So there was kind of communities within communities. This was kind of Jesus' core group, the 12 disciples. And he gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every sickness. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these: the first, Simon, who's called Peter, and his brother Andrew, and James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, the one who also betrayed him. Now, we won't dissect all of these, but I just want to look at these two. Like, two of these people get given a kind of title or a moniker. We get Matthew the tax collector, and we get Simon the Zealot. Now, we talked a little bit about tax collectors tax collectors were not everyone's favorite people, but tax collectors are essentially on the payroll of Rome. And you go around and on behalf of Rome, you collect the tax, and your pay is you take a bit of margin. So you go, well, Rome needs 50%, but I'm going to need 70% from you this year. And so you can imagine these were not the most popular people. They're going around and they're collecting the tax. Often, like, I mean, we read in that passage before, it was tax collectors and sinners. It's like, that's not a good, you know, and sometimes it's like tax collectors and pagans or tax collectors and prostitutes. Like, it's just like, they're not getting lumped in with high society. That's like, these are the, you know, you kind of have this image in your mind of somebody who's this, like, very shrewd, not nice person who's going around collecting all the tax. And we're very in with the Roman Empire. Now, the Zealots were essentially like an extremist Jewish insurgency group. Like, this is as extreme as it gets. These are essentially like running terrorist attacks on the Roman Empire, like violent, like insurgency. This isn't just like a political activism group where they're going, we don't like Rome. This is like, we're talking about people who are violently attacking Rome and trying to resist Rome with violence. And tax collectors are on the payroll of Rome. And Jesus is saying, I'm going to, like, all of you follow me and come and sit in the room and live in community together. Like, and this is just one of the polarities represented in an incredibly diverse group. Like, you can just imagine what it's like at the dinner table. Like, you can imagine the side eye. I don't know that we've got quite an extreme example, but it's like, you can imagine, like, somebody who, like, a far right wing person and a far left wing person being in the same room and being told to, like they're both compelled by this person to follow them, but they're like, there's this tension of values. So, as is to be expected, they tend to get into it. One such example in Matthew 20, the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, what do you desire? She said to him, say that in your kingdom, these two sons of mine shall sit one at your right and one at your left. So she's talking about John and James, sons of Zebedee. And we don't know what she's definitely thinking, but potentially there's this idea that, like, she's thinking Jesus has come to overthrow Rome. Jesus has come to establish God's kingdom on earth. Like, Jesus will be king. And so, you know, I'll get my sons in there with some favor and they can be kind of the lords or whatever the kind of equivalent will be in the kingdom, and they can kind of have a little bit of a little kingdom to themselves, have some power. But Jesus replied, you do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? And Jesus is talking about the suffering that he's going to go through in order to achieve the purpose. And they said to him, we are able. And he said to them, my cup you shall drink. James and John both end up dying as martyrs for their belief in Jesus. But to sit at my right and my left is not mine to give, but is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. And after hearing this, the other 10 disciples became indignant with the two brothers. Kind of rightly so. I mean, they didn't even ask Jesus directly. Their mum, like, gets in the mix. Like, but Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles dominate over them, and those in high position exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wants to become prominent among you shall be your servant, and whoever desires to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. We get this, like, rebuke from Jesus of, like, this is actually not how we do things in my community. Like, to live in the community of God is to live with a whole new set of relational dynamics. Like, this is part of the apprenticeship. Like, it's not just about them becoming great and wise teachers, and they're probably realizing it in this moment. It's actually that Jesus is transforming them to become like him, not just to, you know, do the things that he does, but actually be the person that he is, like, transform their character. And there's this sense of, like, power is not the focus, but love is the focus. It's not explicit in the text, but Jesus establishes that the goal of his community is for his disciples to become like him, who is a sacrificial servant of people that is pervaded by love at the deepest level. Like Jesus says, I'm actually come to serve and be a ransom. Like that's the example I'm about to set for you for this community. All right, I know that was a lot of scripture, so take a breath. But I just want to make a few simple observations before we continue on the life of Jesus as it relates to community. And the first is that Jesus lived in community. Like, let that sink in. He wasn't this kind of like up on a mountain sage with all the wisdom that you came to. And like, he actually established community around himself. And the call to follow him was simultaneously a call to community. Like, you couldn't follow Jesus and not live in his community. He was like essentially a mobile commune. Like, it was like this nomadic little commune that Jesus had going with him. Like, you lived and ate and traveled with Jesus if you were in his community. It seems to me that we cannot follow Jesus alone. The second observation is there's a cost. Lots of people turn down Jesus' invitation, and that the qualification to be in Jesus' community seems to be more about a willingness to pay that cost and commit to the community rather than about any other factor. Because we see the diversity of people who said yes, it didn't matter who they were, what their background was, you know, what they had done, what they're going to do. It actually mattered that they were willing to commit and pay the price and commit to the community. That was Jesus's bar. It was just like, can you pay the cost? You're in. The final observation is just that is that of the end goal of Jesus' community, and it was to form and grow and mature his disciples into people who are like him and who live a life of service. I think it's easy sometimes to distance ourselves from these stories because, you know, we're obviously not in a agrarian Middle Eastern society, so it's not practical for someone to say, follow me, and we all kind of leave our lives and we all travel around Australia on foot. That's obviously not what I'm suggesting to you as the way to do things. But I think, especially at the moment, I think it's worth noticing what Jesus' community is not. And these are the things that we can often mistake for community. The first is like connectivity. And I think it's certainly more of an issue in our world than that of Jesus. But Jesus is not, as I said, this itinerant minister sweeping in and out and just saying like, I'll check in with you as I come through your town. And he's going kind of moving in and out of locations and building his brand. And the call to follow Jesus, as I said, is simultaneously a call to follow him and live in actual community with him. There's kind of an unfortunate redefinition of the idea of following someone in the age of social media. Like, we can easily like follow teachers that we like. I can follow Mark Sayers. I can read all of his books. I can listen to all his podcasts. But I'm not following him in the way that Jesus was asking his disciples to follow him. I'm just kind of like. I mean, and sadly for many Christians, this is our approach to following Jesus. Like, I really love all his content. But like, there's actually a real call to apprenticeship there. It's a call to apprentice under him in order to become like him. That's not going to happen of people who I'm just kind of listening to all the content of. I'm not saying any of that stuff's bad, and I'm like an avid podcast guy. And but it's not a substitution when it comes to the relationship that Jesus is trying to have with us and his community. The second thing we can kind of, that I think Jesus' community is not, and this is kind of obvious in the text, but it's not chemistry. Like, it's not like this, like Jesus brought together all these people who naturally got into a room together and were like, this is crazy. We're going to change the world. We're like really excited about what we're going to do. Like, it was uncomfortable. Like, I'm sure it was extremely uncomfortable in those early days. Like, you basically got, like, the thing that always strikes me when I read about Jesus in the garden, like just before he's taken to be crucified, is when someone pulls a sword and chops someone's ear off, I'm like, they're going around carrying swords. Like it makes you think back and be like, this whole time, like the disciples have had swords on them. Like it'd be like somebody open carrying in this day and age, which is probably weird in Australia and not weird in the States. But like, it puts in perspective just like how like tenuous this whole thing was. It's like at any moment, someone could have just been like, that's it, I've had enough. Like, and just like pulled the sword. I just think Jesus is wild. Like, think about the community that he's, the community dynamic that he's actually saying, this is like, I can manage this. Like, this is okay. This is what I'm looking for. Like, I just think he's chosen such a strange path that it's got to tell us something about the kind of community that he wants to establish. We all have people around us with whom friendship is easy. Like, we have common ground, ideas, passions, hobbies, which is great. It's beautiful when we find that in people. But I want to like pull that as distinct from community, because we can have community with people that we have very little chemistry with, and we can have chemistry with people we have very little community with. It's beautiful when those two overlap, but while they overlap, they're not the same. So if Jesus' community is neither of these things, what is it? There's something so compelling about Jesus that natural enemies can lay aside their agenda to find a commitment to a community. We're in Mark 3 now for this next passage. Then his mother and his brothers came, and while standing outside, they sent word to him, calling for him. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Behold, your mother and your brothers are looking outside for you." Answering them, he said, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" It's kind of rhetorical. It's like, your mother's Mary and your brothers are Jude and James. And looking around, those who were sitting around him, like, it's like no one's responding to Jesus. Like, they probably learned by now, like, this is a teachable moment. Like, don't do it. Don't take the bait. He said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, this is my brother and sister and mother." Notice that for Jesus, his community is his family. What does Jesus most often call God? Father. Like, that's Jesus comes to reveal God as a father. And now he's saying, like, my mother and my brother and my sisters, they're the people around me who do the will of God with me. And the New Testament is saturated with the language of family in terms of describing us. That kind of adelphoi is the Greek word for that, brothers and sisters. Family is the type of community that Jesus is building. And as I said at the start, family sounds really nice in a kind of Christian politeness kind of way, like my brother in Christ. But this is really one of Jesus' most scandalous and radical teachings. Like, Jesus is flipping on its head the culture of the day. Like, this, I think you would have heard this when Jesus said this, of like, you're my brothers and sisters, not my mother and my brothers out there. Like, Jesus is actually saying something incredibly radical in this moment. And Jesus had some pretty scandalous teachings, but I think this is up there. Like, he told people to eat his flesh one time, and like, Jesus was a known provocateur. But two things that made this radical, and it's easy to approach this stuff with our Western brain sometimes and think, oh, we're so much more civilized and evolved than that now, but just have some compassion for our first century neighbors at this point. But anthropologists talk about a strong group and a weak group culture. And Jesus' context, so first century Middle East, is a strong group society. Bruce Molina, who's a theologian, he describes a strong group society as, in a strong group society, the person perceives himself or herself to be a member of a group and responsible to the group for his or her actions, destiny, career, development, life in general. The individual person is embedded in the group and is free to do what he or she feels is right and necessary only if in accord with group norms and only if the action is in the group's best interest. The group has priority over the individual member. Now, that likely sounds uncomfortable and like borderline oppressive to our late modern Western ears. like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean that a group would be more important than me? Because we live in a, probably the logical conclusion of a weak group society where the individual is more important than the group, that our own self-actualization, happiness, desires are more important than any group we might identify with. Strong group cultures tend to have defined roles, like family roles, gender roles, which sounds even more oppressive to us in our like late modern Western way of thinking. Because we've redefined freedom to be do whatever you want as long as it doesn't hurt somebody, which is not a Christian idea of freedom or even a Greek philosophical idea of freedom. So it would not have been the framework of freedom for anyone in Jesus' day. So we tend to judge strong group cultures as oppressive. All that to say that Jesus' culture was a strong group culture and your primary group affiliation was your family. And the second thing that made what Jesus is saying here incredibly radical is the idea that Jesus, the society was what's called patrilineal, patri meaning father. It just meant that your family was defined by who your father was. Like we read that in the genealogies. It's like so-and-so, son of so-and-so, son of so-and-so. Like that's how we trace it down in those days. So your spouse was technically not part of your family, which sounds really scandalous. But marriage was largely arranged, not to say that there wasn't an idea of romantic love, but that was more about what was best for the family. And what it meant was your closest and most intimate relationship was likely with your siblings, your brothers and sisters, because your family was your like primary affiliation. We assume in our culture that it would be your spouse these days. But in these days, like that's how they thought about it. Their brothers and their sisters were their kind of their deepest and most intimate relationships. And what does Jesus call his followers in this moment? Adelphoi, brothers and sisters. So Jesus calls his followers to live like a strong group family, and it's radical not because of the idea of being committed to family. That's a common idea in Jesus' day. People are familiar with this, and really Scripture has been signposting this from the idea of the family of God all the way since Genesis. Like we read about the community of God, let us make mankind in our image. But it's radical because family is defined not by my bloodline, but whoever does the Father's will from the passage. Jesus' vision for a family is a multi-ethnic community made up of Jews, Gentiles, because it doesn't take somebody being in a particular bloodline to do the Father's will, it turns out. Like, Jesus is scandalizing the way of thinking for every Jewish person in the room because they're going, oh, hold on, what's going on here? What does it mean that Jesus is saying to be part of my family is to do the Father's will? We tend to kind of read that and move past the scandal because we don't see it. But in Jesus' world, it was unthinkable that you would basically leave behind your primary group affiliation to be part of something else. Jesus is the oldest living male in his family, and he's kind of responsible, therefore, for them. But Jesus is saying that they're part of a larger family, and that family is more important. We're all familiar with Jesus' pro-family teachings, but there are almost as many teachings that seem to challenge the idea of family. Like, this is probably one of them. It's like, you know, who are your mother and father? Oh, it's all you guys. Actually, forget them. Like, it seems to challenge the idea of family. Jesus says, you must hate your father and mother to come after me. Like, Jesus, are you sure? What are you talking about? Like, or as we read earlier, like, let the dead bury their own dead. Forget your dad. Like, come and follow me. Like, it seems like for as many times that Jesus seems to say, family's a really great thing, there seems to be these ideas that kind of really challenge it. It seems to me like Jesus is almost saying you have to give up your bloodline family in order to join my family. Jesus doesn't like question the strong group dynamic of the culture of the day, but he just says you have to make my group your primary group. And that means for us as kind of late modern Westerners, we're actually committing to being a part of Jesus' strong group community known as the family of God. Now, here's that definition of a strong group with church subbed in instead of strong group. So just pay attention to your heart as we read through this. In the church, the person perceives himself or herself to be a member of the church and responsible to the church for his or her actions, destiny, career, development, and life in general. The individual person is embedded in the church and is free to do what he or she feels right and necessary only if in accord with church norms and only if the action is in the church's best interest. The church has priority over the individual member. Kind of sounds like a cult, to be honest. But really, this is the community that Jesus has created. Like, some of you are like, where is the nearest exit? I'm just going to plan our escape route. And I'm not saying that to, like, it's not a cult. I'll just let you know. But this is the high bar of entry that Jesus is actually establishing for the type of community that he's trying to create. He's not trying to create a community that's just kind of like a bunch of people who happen to be in the same location and we go through a program. Like, he's actually saying, like, there's this massive thing that I'm trying to do. None of us think this way. I mean, unless, like, for most of us, if you grew up in this country, in this culture, we probably don't think this way. That's not to place judgment or condemnation on anyone, but it's just to say, like, we think that way because we've been steeped in a culture of hyper-individualism, right? Like, it's like, you have to be aware that we don't think that way because it's the right way to think necessarily. We think that way because we live in that society where it's like, you know, live your truth, chase your bliss. Like, that's kind of like the message we're getting given every day. But part of saying yes to Jesus is not just being familiar with his ideas, but letting them form us. That we apprentice under Jesus and we adopt his way. And this is his way. Like, this way of family is his way. In the words of Paul, don't conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. We get to function as healthy family. And family is really the place of our deepest hurt and our deepest healing. And it's the place where everything that's beautiful in me shows up and everything that's kind of ugly in me shows up as well. If you ever want to have all of what you're about reflected back to you, like, have a kid. That's a really... So if you'd like a little mirror that shows you exactly what you're like, have children. We had it all yesterday. We had a really beautiful day. We saw the Dodds. We both happened to be going to Dough Heads. So if you've never been to Dough Heads in Junction, highly recommend. Great donuts. So we were just having a great family day. We're having donuts and coffee and all sorts. And then we just kind of all like lost it at dinner. Like, we, so it was just like, we just had the full spectrum of like everything that was beautiful. All of my love and affection and, time with the family, like all of that was coming out, like, and all these beautiful characteristics. And then all of my anger and control came out as well. And it's like, oh man, like, there's something, like, if you were to watch me during my day, you'd think, like, I'm probably the nastiest with my family because I'm like, that's the place where I'm real. Like, that's the place where I, like, am safe and I show up. I'm not saying I'm horrible to my family, but it's like, that's where it comes out, right? We know this about ourselves. Like, the people that we love the most tend to be the ones that are in the path of our worst behavior and our worst moments. That's just like, there's something about family that just brings that out of us because it's the place where we are real. We're safe to be real. Like, it doesn't feel vulnerable for me to be angry in that context because it's just like, you know, we are family. We're committed to one another and we'll work it out and we'll, you know, we work through all that. But yeah, this is what family's like. We experience all of it together. And I feel like the call of God for this community in this season is almost a return back to the simplicity of family. I want to reflect just as we come into a close here, just on like, what are the basic practices of a healthy family to kind of inspire us maybe and probably challenge us mostly. The basic things that like typify a healthy family. And there may be others, but these are probably a great place to start. So I believe a healthy family eats together. Like, I think that when we think about, we've kind of reduced communion down to a bread and wine moment, but and it's really like a private confession moment in which I have a private moment where I confess with Jesus. But Jesus wasn't saying, here's the bread and the wine, do this in remembrance of me. He was like, do this in remembrance of me. Like, we're feasting together. So I think there's something to be said about the communion of the followers of Jesus. Like, that's actually a practice of the family. I mean, it's a practice of real families as well. I think there's so much value to eating together and like actually spending time at the table in fellowship in that way. A family does life together. They spend time together. They're loving and affectionate. They hold each other accountable, which maybe looks like discipline for a younger member or intervention for an older member. Like all families kind of live in this balance of loving acceptance and loving accountability. Like there's a sense in which it's kind of like that story we read of the disciples where Jesus was like, actually, this is what it's like in the family. It's like bringing it back to the standard of like, this is how we operate in this family, in this community. Like this is how power works. We're not looking for position. We're actually looking to serve. Families share resources and share responsibilities. Like I think of Christmas dinner. Most of the time in functional families, like everybody's on the move. Like there's people putting stuff out, and when it comes time to do the dishes, people are chipping in. Hopefully. And everyone's getting stuff. Like it's like you're part of the family. You're part of the responsibility. In Sarah's family, I think the younger members, like whoever hasn't been part of the family for the longest, kind of gets a little bit like, oh, you've got to do the dishes. Like, so I did my time. Like I get to sit on the couch and drink wine now. But Hannah's boyfriend last Christmas, he was in the kitchen and he needed to be. I mean, it sounds funny, but like to some extent, like that's a demonstration of like, hey, if you want to be part of this family, like this is what it looks like to be part of this family. It's like committing and if you don't like it, leave. They still have the option. Some people don't. But most of us, if it's your own family, like you don't have that option. Families make decisions together. They release one another into their destiny and they're faithful to each other until death. That's a high call to be that kind of a community. The challenge for you this week is to start somewhere. Pick something and make a meaningful movement towards it. The invitation I want to make as we close this morning, two invitations. One is, as we've talked about family this morning, that can be an uncomfortable thought for a lot of people. That can surface some stuff that, you know, maybe you don't have a particularly fond memory of the idea of family. I want to make room for ministry, whether it's for that or for other things. If you've got healing needs, things like that, then we're happy to pray for that as well. So I want to make that available if you want to be prayed for. The second invitation is to, and I realize I didn't have any discussions this morning, which for some of you, you were like, oh, praise the Lord. And then others of you, you were like, where was that? He didn't. So I want to give you an opportunity now to just turn in and discuss with somebody near you, like what does this look like for you? Like, what do you think is an actual tangible action you can take this week to actually say yes to Jesus' idea of family in our community? So I'll give you the opportunity to do that now. Thanks for listening.